From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Michigan business leader fumes as the state Senate tries to find money to fix the roads.
Nobody's being asked to build a spaceship to Mars. This is something that lawmakers across the country do on a regular basis.
We look at the new president of the United Auto Workers Union.
He's the first president of the UAW who never headed one of the UAW's big three departments, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. He didn't work in an auto plant, and he's just a very different kind of cat.
And enjoying summer travel in Michigan while steering clear of the crowds.
Almost nobody is in these state forest campgrounds when, you know, Holland State Park is packed with people from ear to ear.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. More than 60% of Americans want high-speed rail. The reasoning? Faster trip times, lower cost, and greater convenience. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what could more and higher speed rail travel mean to us here in Michigan and in the U.S.? Then the unemployment rate for teens is expected to top 26% in Michigan this summer. But how much does it actually matter to Michigan's economy and to the teens? That story later this hour. But first, attempts in the state Senate to come up with more than $1 billion a year to fix roads fell apart last night after lawmakers spent 15 hours in session. Well, it appears they're back at it today before they leave town to start summer campaigning in their districts. Rich Studley is president and CEO of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. The chamber is pushing for lawmakers to come up with some kind of solution for road funding. Rich, first off, is there a plan there and a certain amount of money for roads that the chamber is endorsing?
The governor has put forward a comprehensive plan calling for about $1.2 billion in additional investment. The state house has approved a plan to reallocate $450 million in revenue. So many individuals and groups from different segments of our state believe that we need to invest $1 billion or more to get Michigan's transportation system back into the good quality that we really need for jobs and the economy.
But your feeling, what about the chamber? Because there's a big difference between $450 million and $1.2
billion. Our view is that we need to get back to investing at a pretty high level in our roads and bridges. They've been allowed to deteriorate really across the state. There's strong support in the business community. The direction we've been given by the Michigan Chambers Board is that we should advocate for $1.6 billion in additional revenue. We can hit that target if Democrats and Republicans and business and labor work together. I think the challenge is the legislature's waited so long. You probably can't do it at once. This kind of package will need to be phased in over probably a 3 to 5 year period. That's made it a tough challenge even more difficult.
And we saw the state Senate working not just through the wee hours of the night, but into the morning hours today in Lansing. And it just appears the votes are not there for that increase in road funding. And yet we see from polls and even lawmakers admit voters want the roads fixed. What does this say to you about what's happening at the Capitol right now and what we're seeing from lawmakers?
Well, there's an old saying, if at first you don't succeed, try again. So our message to Michigan's lawmakers is that our roads and bridges are crumbling. The transportation system is in a crisis. We did release a statewide public opinion poll last month that showed a dramatic swing in public opinion, now strongly in favor of a comprehensive plan to build better roads and improve public transit. Motorists know that that's not free. They're willing to pay for it. So we've been lobbying very hard to educate and inform lawmakers about the options, and there really is no good reason why the legislature has to recess for the summer tomorrow. Most of your listeners are not going to get 2 months off this summer before they run for re-election in August and November. And so our message is stay in session and do your job. While Michigan's lawmakers have been talking and talking and talking about this issue, virtually every other state in the country has tackled the same problem. In fact, a few months ago, lawmakers in Pennsylvania approved a $2.3 billion package with bipartisan support. So nobody's being asked to build a spaceship to Mars. This is something that lawmakers across the country do on a regular basis.
And when I think of where you sit as president and CEO of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, so you are speaking for businesses in Michigan, and we've heard nothing but a clear message from our Republican governor that he wants this to be a business-friendly state. You have Republican-controlled House and Senate. One would think you would be able to see this kind of action happen to help the businesses, because I can only imagine this has the condition of the roads and our transportation infrastructure has a lot of impact on the businesses and the groups you represent.
It does. At the Michigan Chamber, we're a statewide business organization. We represent companies of every size and type in all 83 of Michigan's counties, and we have heard strong feedback from our members that this issue needs to be a priority, that it's about jobs in the economy. And this investment in roads and bridges and public transit is really all about helping employers and employees everywhere in the state. All three of our leading industries, manufacturing, agribusiness, travel and tourism, are heavily dependent on the quality of our transportation system. And every year the legislature doesn't act, we lose about $100 million in value. And Michigan's motorists now, in effect, pay an inaction tax of over $300 a year in unnecessary road repairs. I myself recently had to replace a windshield. That cost over $300. That's a lot less than it would take to fix the roads.
I'm hearing from people calling it the pothole tax after $900 to fix some kind of a bent rim or something like that. I have to wonder, Rich, is this? Are you, as the president and the CEO of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, speaking for so many Michigan businesses, you throwing down the gauntlet on the table of the House and Senate more than the governor? I mean, he asked for this a year and a half ago. Is this really more on them, or is there more the governor could or should be doing to help make this happen?
When Governor Snyder was elected, lawmakers wanted the administration to put forward a plan. The governor put forward a comprehensive plan. Many of the lawmakers who wanted the governor to take the lead then didn't like the governor's plan and have had a lot of difficulty in coming up with constructive alternatives. So I wouldn't say that we're throwing down the gauntlet. I would say that we're absolutely determined to see this issue resolved. For better or worse, we have a full-time legislature. They all volunteered to be in Lansing. They are paid and well paid to make decisions and take actions on a key issue like this. We believe that this is the right thing to do and that lawmakers will be rewarded by their constituents. There are a lot of motorists out there who are very frustrated with the worst pothole season in over a decade, and they're going to support lawmakers who do the right thing. And that, I think part of the challenge here is the political calculation has changed. It used to be that the safe bet was to do nothing. We now believe that lawmakers who do nothing are going to be held accountable by the motorists and other voters in their district for missing this opportunity.
Rich Studley is president and CEO of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Rich, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Energy use around the globe is expected to go up by more than 50% over the next 25 years. Michigan law is mandating a heavier reliance on renewable sources by next year, but some say that's not enough. Stateside's Emily Fox reports on a couple in northern Michigan trying to live completely off the grid, and it's a lot harder than you might think for reasons you might not expect.
Rolf and Mari von Waldhausen were a typical Traverse City couple. They worked 40-hour-week jobs and lived in an average-sized home. But one day, they did an experiment.
We moved all our belongings into one room in the house and said, let's see how it is to live in a space that's 12 by 16.
Then they tried another experiment.
There was a time that one summer at our house, we actually set up the tent in the yard, and we lived in this tent for 4 months.
Then came the big test.
We're up on the hill, just behind those pine trees.
The von Waldhausens sold their house, quit their day jobs, and built a tiny cabin in the woods with no running water or electricity.
We call this our Thoreau's Cabin because this is the place where we get a lot of our inspiration for living the way we do.
The von Waldhausens got new part-time jobs teaching yoga and tuning pianos. They were living in the woods, getting their water from a stream nearby, gathering wood to heat their wood-burning stove, and using their compostable toilet outside. Rolf von Waldhausen says living off the grid is hard work, but he and his wife love it.
This way you get to be out in nature, you know, 365 days a year, and really getting into those natural rhythms that we in modern society have lost.
And they started getting closer to their neighbors. They'd trade things like tools for eggs and syrup. Mari von Waldhausen says they began spending time with people more than they ever could before.
Most people in most neighborhoods have no idea who even lives next door because you get home after dark and again, you just collapse.
Life was good. Well, that's until the local zoning and health officials found out. Turns out there are two major problems with the von Waldhausen's lifestyle.
A habitable dwelling should have running water to it and should have a means of sanitary disposal of the sewage. That's what our code requires.
That's Clay McNitt with the Benzie-Leelanau Health Department. The second problem is that their 200-square-foot house is actually too small to be considered livable in their township. Tim Johnson is the chairperson for the Centerville Township Planning Commission. He says the von Waldhausen's house is four times smaller than the township minimum.
The ordinance was first written in 1976. It was first enacted primarily, although no one will admit this, but to keep single-wide mobile homes out of the township.
Johnson and the von Waldhausens fought the township board to get rid of the square foot minimum, but the board voted against it. The von Waldhausens are not giving up. They can't legally live in their cabin, but they can stay in a tent on each of their three parcels of land for 2 months at a time. So that's what they're doing. They're living in a tent for 6 months, then house-sitting for friends and neighbors the rest of the year.
It's crazy to try and navigate basically these power struggles in government.
Government officials say this wouldn't be as much of a struggle. That's if the von Waldhausens would have talked with the proper local authorities before they started this journey. The von Waldhausens say they knew living completely off the grid probably wasn't legal in the first place. But despite the bureaucratic and political hurdles, they are committed to living off their land as much as they can. Under the stars and under the law. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's quite a buzz going on about Michigan and the travel business. Well, at least among the people who make up all of those top 10 and cool places to visit lists. Michigan destinations are working their way onto those lists. Saugatuck was voted number one summer weekend escape in America in a recent USA Today reader poll. And a somewhat obscure Upper Peninsula drive got on a top 10 best U.S. road trips list. Detroit Free Press travel writer Ellen Krieger joins us. Ellen, what's up with this? Are Michigan destinations just suddenly cool?
Part of it is a payoff from the Pure Michigan campaign, which is now 7 years old. So you know that the word is being spread beyond Michigan's borders, that Michigan is really a beautiful state, and other people are realizing that. However, I think a lot of it has to do with that the media is full of lazy copycats. So if somebody reads that about Saugatuck on one best list, they're more likely to put it onto another best list. The big surprise was that road trip in the Upper Peninsula, which no one has ever heard of, and that shows that reporter really did go there by themselves, take that trip, and like it.
And this was the Black River Scenic Byway. What can you tell us about that?
Not much. I haven't been on it myself, but it's near Bessemer in western, far, far western Michigan, and travels, you know, through beautiful forests and waterfalls and that sort of thing. But it's pretty obscure, and the hilarious thing is they gave, as a side trip, Mackinac Island, which is, you know, several hours east.
Whoops. Yeah, not quite easy to do from there. But interesting to see something that isn't the usual. Instead of putting Mackinac on there, saying, no, go further and go deep into the Upper Peninsula.
That's right. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about these best list.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you're seeing is USA Today, the sister paper of the Free Press, bought a company called 10best.com, and every single week they run a poll of about travel, and they're all about best, like the 10 best motels in Savannah, the 10 best islands in the United States, that sort of thing. That's why you keep seeing all of a sudden these destinations saying that they're on this 10 best list. What they don't say is that these 10 best lists are coming out every single week.
Gotcha. But, you know, it's interesting. I know as a potential traveler, I do clip those out and keep them. I actually printed off the UP Drive, that 10 best road trips list, to keep that in mind. Do they make a difference to anyone besides me?
I think they're fun. What I would tell people is that you need to look at more of the fine print. I mean, if you just see a 10 best list, fine, and it's fun. But usually they're pretty predictable. I would look at how authoritative is this list. One I really like is people have seen the best beaches list in the United States.
Yes.
It's put out every year by Dr. Stephen Leatherman, who is known as Dr. Beach. Well, he's an expert in sand, and he's a professor in coastal research for Florida International University. He actually analyzes grains of sand and pollution data for these beaches. And so his list every year is very authoritative. That's a lot different than editors at the Travel Channel sitting around the office and whipping up some best bikini beach list.
That makes total sense. You know, some Michiganders like to avoid those hot, popular tourist spots in the busy season. They want to escape the crowds. I'm just curious, because you're the Free Press travel writer, if you want to soak up Michigan's beauty and not have to fight crowds, what makes your cut?
All right. Find places, if you want to travel in the summer, look at all those top 10 lists and don't go there in June or July. But, you know, anyone from Michigan knows there are 8 zillion places that people out of state don't know about. So I once did this hidden gems list, sort of basically my favorite underappreciated spots in Michigan. And one of my favorites is Lumberman's Monument, west of Alpena, right on the Asabo. I think that's beautiful. The other place is that Great Lakes Maritime Heritage Center. It's a museum in Alpena. It's part of that Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And that's a great museum. It's off a lot of people's lists. Or any state forest campground. Almost nobody is in any state forest campgrounds when, you know, Holland State Park is packed with people from ear to ear. So,
sure.
There are a lot of places in Michigan that are not crowded, even in the summer, and just find those and enjoy.
Detroit Free Press travel writer Ellen Krieger, as always, thanks so much, Ellen.
Sure, thanks.
The United States has certainly lagged behind other nations in high-speed rail, including trains with top speeds of up to 180 miles an hour. What would it take for us to catch up? That question, among others, is being tackled in a study digging into Americans' thoughts on high-speed rail. Wayne State University, in partnership with the University of Michigan and Drexel University, has launched this 2.5-year study. Alan Betteau is a cultural anthropologist and an associate professor of anthropology at Wayne State. He's the leader of the study. Pleasure to have you with us, Alan.
Thank you.
And joining us is co-investigator Susan Zielinski. Susan's an urban planner, and she's head of SMART at the University of Michigan. That stands for Sustainable Mobility Access Research and Transformation. Quite the mouthful, but very important. Good to have you with us, Susan.
Great to be here.
I have to say, on just first thought, one might think that an engineer would be the one leading this study, Alan. Why is a cultural anthropologist leading a study on high-speed rail?
Well, for the last 20 years, I've been directing a program in business anthropology, which is a unique program we have at Wayne State where we study contemporary institutions and contemporary technologies. And one of my specialties is the anthropology of transportation and of travel, whether automobiles, airplanes, trains, and the like.
So are we talking about the ideas and feelings behind it versus the execution and implementation?
Exactly correct. Yeah, I mean, obviously the hardware, the operations is a reality, but equally important is how people imagine it, how people think about it, because imagination often leads reality. Humans imagined flying for hundreds of years before the Wright brothers were able to do it. Jules Verne landed a man on the moon more than 100 years before the Apollo program. And in fact, his novel about that, From the Earth to the Moon, was an inspiration for the Apollo program and an inspiration for the Tom Hanks movie, From the Earth to the Moon.
Yes, yes, yes. So we think it,
and start shedding light out into the future by these imaginations. Yeah. What's the study meant to accomplish, Susan?
Well, what we do at SMART is we look at the future of transportation, how it's going to evolve. And it's not just about one mode of transportation. It's about a whole host of different kinds of options. Mm-hmm. So as we move into the future, it's a little bit like, you know how your laptop connects to your printer, your camera, uh-huh. your everything, your desktop. That's how transportation's evolving. Many, many different options that are more connected. So when we look at all the different types of modes, when we look at high-speed rail, how is that going to fit into this really exciting, multimodal, very IT-supported system or portfolio of options that we're going to have? So we're interested at SMART from that point of view. How are people thinking about the whole future of transportation, and where can high-speed rail fit in to support that exciting and sustainable future?
When we talk about this new study, and you're going to spend a couple of years, more than 2 years, looking into this, and you also have many partners around the world. Where yeah. Who else is involved?
Well, the study is sponsored by the Mobile Lives Forum, which is a research institute in Paris that is looking at the future of – their objective is to look to the future of mobility in the year 2030. So they're looking out 20 years. And they've got – there's a parallel study to this going on in France, and mm-hmm. we are in regular communication with them. They're also getting another study started in South Africa of high-speed rail and another in India. And I think they might have ideas for some other countries as well. But the idea is there's these parallel studies around the world on how do people imagine high-speed rail.
How will you go about this? Aha! Says the lead investigator with a big smile.
Well, it takes it. I would say three things. Okay. First of all, I mean, we listen to people a lot. We study what's in the media. We interview people. We talk to knowledgeable people. We talk to planners, policymakers, and so forth. I mean, that's the empirical part of it. But equally important is kind of that we have to be able to stretch our minds to understand their imagination. There's – in anthropology, there's a concept of requisite imagination. In other words, if you have a very narrow imagination, you cannot imagine very much. So we as researchers have to stretch our minds as well to get in tune with what people are telling us. And it's on several different levels and different registers. I mean the first level is as you start it, we're behind the rest of the world. We're mm-hmm. 30 years behind the rest of the world, maybe 40 years. Okay. And that's a serious point. And so why can't we catch up? Well, people tell you we can't afford it.
Okay.
Who's going to pay for it? But my mind tells me there's something else going on beneath the surface here. 150 years ago, roughly speaking, we completed the Transcontinental Railway because people imagined unifying the continent.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there was an imaginary of America as a unified nation, okay, which
yes.
we had. And this was right after the Civil War, incidentally.
Sure.
Okay. We had that 150 years ago. I'm not so sure we have that nowadays.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we'll see if that exists. And I know that's certainly something that at SMART that concerns you, Susan. And I wonder, do you think to most people high-speed rail matters?
I think getting around matters. I think being able to meet your needs matters.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about transportation, it's not so much, you know, this mode of transportation really matters to me. It's actually, can I get the stuff I need to get done? You know, can mm-hmm. I have fun? Can I get to work? Can I take care of my kids? Can I play? And so really how that happens, it really helps if it's really efficient because then you get to get more stuff done. And it really helps if it's safe because you get to live to see the next thing get done.
Sure.
So I think really high-speed rail is important because it adds to that efficiency of the whole system of all the transportation opportunities coming together, and especially from the point of view of moving from city to city, because right now there's a real push towards integrated mobility within the city and within a region.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important, and that's beginning to evolve. And high-speed rail is a wonderful link to link from city to city.
But yet we've seen here in the U.S. some states and regions embracing and moving ahead with HSR, and others have rejected or canceled projects. What, Ellen, what do you think drives the difference, whether it's a yes or a no to high-speed rail?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. First of all is what sense of regional consciousness is there? For example, in the Northeast Corridor, you have a very strong regional consciousness, and not surprisingly, they're well ahead of the rest of the country in terms of high-speed rail. California, likewise.
And might I say, knowing that for much of that area, let's talk about New York City, owning a car is not a convenient option the way it might be if you lived in a suburb here in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So it forces it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you were saying California.
California has its own regional culture, its own regional consciousness, and they're pushing ahead. So those are the positive forces. Here in the Midwest, it's a toss-up. I mean, here in Michigan, we would consider ourselves lucky if we could get around the south of the lake at 60 miles per hour.
Right.
I'm not making this up.
Oh, I agree.
So transportation is a public good, okay? And transportation systems, whether the infrastructure or the rolling stock or the planning, always come from, in one way or another, from government, from collective action, okay? But there's in the last 30 years, there's been this big pushback against any government initiative, which from my perspective is, I'll be diplomatic and I'll say it's just short-sighted, okay? But people don't realize that if you're going to have a nation, you have to have a national government.
So you're saying let's look at the pros and cons of having some kind of a unified, coherent structure. Mm-hmm. And I would guess, too, Susan Zielinski, that it depends if you get viewpoints, depends on the generation. Mm-hmm. There are those of us who are used to everybody in the family having a car in the driveway, and then there are – we certainly hear a lot of talk about millennials being resistant to even getting a driver's license, let alone car ownership. And I'm sure their view of – the ability of high-speed rail is perhaps different than mom or dad's or grandpa's.
Yeah, that's a real shift lately here in the U.S. and even in the U.K., and it's actually even beginning in some of these places like China, which are emerging economies, and you'd think for sure the biggest thing, China and India, status to own a car. But in some cases, that's true. But in some cases, it's just, yes, we'll own the car, but we actually really want access to everything we want at this moment. So we should be able to move from one mode of transportation to the other seamlessly using our iPhone. We should be able to have access to our social networks that support our transportation. And really, you know, getting your first car at 16 is not the status symbol it used to be.
Yeah.
It used to be that that meant you'd arrived or, you know, in an emerging economy, okay, our cities arrived or our families arrived. We've got a car. But now that's kind of beginning to diminish, which is kind of exciting.
Which you see opens the door to something like high-speed rail. What do you hope, Ellen, in 2.5 years as this study is concluded, what do you hope it will contribute to the dialogue about high-speed rail in this country?
My fondest hope here would be that we can move away from the simplistic discussion we have right now of, oh, we can't afford it, and more to have a vision that this is something that brings us together. I would say the Transcontinental Railway united the country, but more importantly, the vision of the Transcontinental Railway kind of created this sense of we are a nation. Mm-hmm. We are a unified nation.
And your thoughts, your hopes, Susan?
Well, on that note, I think it's really important for us to think about not only how we feel about a nation, but how do we feel about how we live our lives. And when you think about the everyday politics of things, you think, oh, it's just political. It's all about money. It's all about power.
It's all fighting.
Yeah, but
finger pointing. Yeah.
Yeah, and I used to work at a kind of a big municipality north of the border that has a very famous mayor right now. And, you know, that's a place that's pretty intricate. But, you know, every once in a while you get a situation where maybe a city councilor has a daughter that has asthma and wants sustainable transportation. Or you have someone who really grew up, you know, taking the train and sees the train as something that has to be part of society, has to be part of everyday life. And it's those visions and imaginations that can really drive not only our individual decisions, but the decisions of decision makers and how we perceive of the world.
If I were to kind of summarize in a phrase, I would like to give a voice to the imagination.
Beautiful. Alan Bateau, cultural anthropologist and associate professor of anthropology at Wayne State University, and Susan Zielinski, urban planner and head of SMART at the University of Michigan, both being a big part of a big study that's being done into the future of high-speed rail in the U.S. and beyond. Pleasure to talk with you both. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is a crucial transition time for the United Auto Workers Union. New UAW President Dennis Williams is picking up from where predecessor Bob King left off. Detroit News columnist Daniel House has been thinking about this. You know this as a business columnist, Daniel. Dennis Williams brings some firsts to the job of UAW president. What are those?
Well, he's the first, for starters, he's the first president of the UAW who never headed one of the UAW's big three departments, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. He didn't work in an auto plant. He just does not have that kind of pedigree. And he's just a very different kind of cat. But I think a very important one as we come out of, this will be the first major contract, really post bailout. I mean, there was one in 2011, but that was pretty well cooked by the terms of the bailout. So I think this is going to be the first more regular, if you will, contract, and it's going to be done at a very different time for this industry. All three companies are profitable. GM and Ford, very profitable in their home markets, which is what really matters to the United Auto Workers negotiations. And I think there's going to be a real attempt to essentially claw back some of the things that were, quote, lost. So there's going to be a big battle, rhetorically at least, over how they're going to do that. There hasn't been a base wage increase by the hourly worker in the big three plants in probably more than a decade. They've been able to share the wealth by increasing their profit-sharing plans and their profit-sharing payout formulas, and they've been pretty handsome, and I expect that that's going to happen again this time. But I think there's little question that they're going to be able to get through this without some kind of base wage increase, among other things.
Remind us again, when are the contracts up and when do they start talking?
It would be up, I would think. I'm not sure the exact date, but probably mid-September 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And the times of when they start to talk has been changing over the years. It used to start in June of that year and really go through the whole summer and then culminate hopefully in a contract by mid-September. Under Ron Gettelfinger and more recently under Bob King, those they've started a lot later. And they've moved a lot more quickly, and I would expect that trend to continue. I think that there's a more of a sophistication about what they do. They meet much more regularly throughout the contract periods, the companies with the unions, and so the issues are not so the list of issues is usually not as long as it has been in the past. Plus, the fact is that the workforces are much smaller.
True,
and I think they've come to agreement on a couple of things, one of which is that they have to be competitive and that they cannot be paying wages and benefits that are dramatically higher than their foreign-owned competition that are operating mostly in the American South.
Dennis Williams, then he gets about a year or so to kind of get his sea legs, if you will, as president of the UAW. And you believe, you say in your column today in the Detroit News, that Dennis Williams very much needs to chart some new courses from his predecessor, Bob King. And I get a sense you're looking not only in terms of style, but actions. Talk about style first. In what ways do you think Bob King was going down the wrong road for the UAW?
Well, I've questioned for some time two fundamental notions about Bob King. One was him talking about being a solutions-oriented UAW leader and trying to be a problem solver on one hand. And then on the other hand, threatening companies and claiming, you know, in the case of one Asian automaker, that they were violating human rights violators and being a lot more belligerent and confrontational. And I think people, those to most thinking people that look at that, those two positions are somewhat incompatible. Mm. So you're kind of either one or the other, but which is it? And the second thing is Bob King was is a very politically active UAW president. Now, it's important to note that most union presidents are politically active. But Bob King was pretty singular in his activity and made some choices and did some things as president of the UAW that were arguably very deleterious to organized labor in Michigan and around the country.
Case in point, Proposal 2.
Case in point, Proposal 2. You know, I had reported several times. I, in fact, did an interview with him after Proposal 2 went down, in which he admitted to me on the record that the governor of Michigan did, in fact, tell him before they submitted the signatures with the petitions not to do this, that it would come back to haunt him. And the phrase that he used was, don't kick the elephant. And there were a lot of Democrats and union insiders who essentially agreed with the governor, who advised the president not to go ahead with this. But Bob King went ahead with it anyway.
So that failure to enshrine collective bargaining in the state constitution opened the door to right to work.
I think even among union people, they refer to him as the father of right to work.
Wow.
And now that could have some implications next year if you have some UAW members who start to say, you know what, I don't want to pay my dues. I'm going to opt out. So, I mean, could that be five people? Could it be 50? Could it be 500? I don't know. But I think that door has been opened, and in part it's been opened by misreading the political winds in Michigan when you had Republicans controlling both houses of the legislature and a Republican governor. And they were given the opening here by the pushing of Proposal 2, and they took it.
The other thing you point out is he did a lot of globetrotting and a lot of tinkering, if you will, and meetings with overseas unions.
Yes, I've been very skeptical of that notion for a very long time, predating Bob King. There have been efforts to do, you know, transnational alliances between unions, but I spent 4 years living and working in Germany and having some familiarity with IG Metall. I've been in auto plants in Belgium and in Sweden. And I can tell you that I think union concerns are very much a national issue. It depends on the political culture of a country. It depends on the labor laws of that country. And so as a practical matter, I think transnational alliances really are pretty meaningless to people who are living and working in a country. And for a UAW member, what really matters to them is the kind of contract they have and the company they're working for, whether they are profitable or not, and whether the products they're building are good products that are popular in the marketplace. Those are the kind, there's all, and all the issues that are wrapped up into those questions are what really matters. Not whether your president is off at an International Labor Federation meeting in Geneva, which is where Bob King was when I interviewed him in that post-right-to-work vote interview, which I thought was very ironic. Mm. I mean, there he's on the phone talking to me from the most expensive city in Europe, if not the world.
Do you hear things? It's only the first week, brand new, but do you hear anything or sense anything about Dennis Williams as a leader that makes you feel like he is up to the challenges he faces?
I can tell you that the people at the companies that I talk to at fairly high levels are very more optimistic about Dennis. They recognize that this is a guy who was not in the room in 08 and 09 when Ron Gettelfinger and Bob King, frankly, were working with the government and the companies to try and save the industry. This is not a guy who came up through the Ford department or the GM department. In the case of Gettelfinger and King, they both had come up through the Ford department, so they knew that company intimately, and they knew the players very well. But I think they see this as Dennis Williams as somebody who can be an innovative bargainer, who can look at ideas in different ways, and they're optimistic. I think you said it at the top, and I think it's true. We're moving into a new phase of leadership in this industry, in this town. You've got a new CEO at General Motors. You're going to have a new CEO at Ford in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. You got a new president of the UAW. you know, the old geezer in all of this is Sergio Marchionne. And I say that with quotes, but he's the one who's been around the longest here in that leadership position. So I think we're – and the other thing that you have to lay on top of all of this is an industry that is pretty consistently profitable for the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an expectation given the contracts that they have and the efficiencies that they've been able to deliver that they will be profitable over the longer term.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
As school ends and summer begins, the challenge in many Michigan households is teens trying to find a summer job. The unemployment rate for teens in Michigan is expected to hit 26.5% this summer, somewhat better than last year's level. Now, this all certainly matters to parents who are not too thrilled about a 17-year-old sitting around all summer playing Xbox. But how much does it matter to Michigan's economy and to the teens? Charles Ballard is an economist with Michigan State University. How does that 26.5% compare to teen unemployment in Michigan, let's say, over the past 10 years, Charlie?
Well, teen unemployment, ever since I've been looking at the data, has always been very substantially higher than adult unemployment, which is not all that surprising when you think teens are the ones with the least skills, the least experience. They haven't yet plugged into the labor force very well. One thing to remember about all these unemployment statistics is that the unemployment rate, that's the percentage of the people who are actively seeking work.
Right.
And a lot of teens, maybe they've got an unpaid internship. Maybe they're doing summer school. Maybe they have, maybe they're trying to go the athletics route and they're going to summer sports camps. There are so many other possibilities. And if you've got one of those other things, like say maybe you're in a study abroad program, you're not even in the labor force, and so then you're not counted as unemployed.
So when we see the statistic that I saw from the state figuring about 178,000 Michigan kids aged 16 to 19 will be working, and that leaves a little more than 64,000 who will not, are those the kids who do want to find a job, or are those the kids who may or may not want to have a job?
Those are the ones who are looking for a job.
All right.
And so for that group, that is a problem. What I'm just trying to emphasize mm-hmm. is that there are all sorts of other things. And for that group, what we hope is that if they have trouble finding a job, if they sit around playing video games, that's not such a good outcome. But there are lots of things. You can volunteer. You can do some sort of study, even if it doesn't get you credit. Or you can go to summer school. There are. It's not like if you can't find a summer job when you're 17 years old, that's the end of the world.
Well, the other thing that strikes me is that I'm sure there are many kids who aren't working in a formal work setting, but they could be babysitting, they could be doing yard work for neighbors, and they could be making some money. And I have to imagine there's no way to measure how much of that's going on.
Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, of course, tries to measure all sorts of things, but all of these numbers are measured with error. They're based on a sample survey, and so you know you should take all employment statistics with at least 3 grains of salt.
But have we seen, because of the recession in Michigan in particular, have more kids been squeezed out by adults who were bumped down the job ladder during the recession?
Yes, like I've just said, yeah. the quality of the data are not that fabulous. But it appears that at least some of the younger folks, maybe one of the things that's keeping them from being able to find a job is what you say, that adults lost a better job and then end up doing some sort of entry-level job where they're competing with the teenager. But the reduction in teen employment is really a long-term phenomenon. And it was not just because of the recession. It was going on before the recession. There was this long-term decline. I think that's because there are so many other options available that we were talking about. Mm. The number of teens who are actually working has been going down. Fortunately, that doesn't mean that all of those people are just sitting around twiddling their thumbs.
Finding things to do. And so it does seem to indicate that if you don't find a paycheck and a job, it does, as you say, it's not the end of the world, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have a harder time in the job market as adults if you haven't worked through high school.
It could, in some cases, have a negative effect.
But, such as?
If you didn't have a good educational resume, if you're a high school dropout, for instance, and then you don't have some work experience to sort of offset your lack of formal educational skills, that would be a big problem. That's sort of the very bottom of the labor market that I'm most worried about. But that doesn't apply to most young people. And I believe that in most cases, the penalty from not finding that summer job is likely to be small. In fact, one of the things that I would like to see us do in Michigan, trying to improve the educational outcomes, is to have a longer school year. And that would cut into the amount of time that young people could work in the labor market in the summer. But it would also mean that their educational skills would be better. The thing that you're looking for to have a good career is some sort of skill. You can get that through formal education, through things like Career Quest. You can get it through apprenticeships. You can get it through volunteer work. You can get it through summer jobs. You can get it in all sorts of ways.
And what are the chances? What kind of movement, conversation is happening at all about lengthening the school year?
Well, I'm trying to generate some conversation.
you do very regularly.
I've been saying this for years. It doesn't exactly have traction in Lansing so far as I can tell, and that I think is largely because it would cost money.
Yeah.
I don't think that we could lengthen the school year appreciably without it costing some, and we've seen with the roads issue how extremely difficult it is to raise revenues even when everybody agrees that there's a huge problem. And so I will keep making the case that when you look at all the other developed countries in the world, they have a longer school year than the U.S., and in an awful lot of cases they have much better educational outcomes. I think that's the direction in which we need to go, even if that would mean less of a time for summer jobs.
Michigan State University economics professor Charles Ballard. As always, a pleasure. Thanks so much, Charles.
Thank you for having me.
The group that was trying to make Michigan's legislature go part-time is suspending its campaign. The Committee to Restore Michigan's Part-Time Legislature did not gather enough signatures to get the question of a part-time legislature on the November ballot. Their plan would have cut lawmakers' pay to $35,000 a year and limited the days lawmakers would be in session to 60 days a year. On its website, the committee says it's not ending its campaign, but rather suspending it. And the group says they hope to begin their effort anew in 2016. You can find more stories about the effort to make Michigan a part-time legislature, including interviews we've done on Stateside, at michiganradio.org. Stateside was directed and produced by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Omar Saadeh, Kayla Steinberg, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.